This is Studio 360. We are on stage at the Brooklyn Academy of Music talking about, among other things, what scares us. Jennifer Egan had sent just really a handful of tweets ever when she decided to do something pretty bold, if not scary, to publish a story on Twitter. People had tweeted fiction before, but not anybody who had just won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. What if it bombed? It didn't bomb. It killed. The story is called Black Box. It's a sci-fi thriller. And ladies and gentlemen, here's Jennifer Egan to read some of it for you.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. Black Box. People rarely look the way you expect them to, even when you've seen pictures. The first 30 seconds in a person's presence are the most important. If you're having trouble perceiving and projecting, focus on projecting. Necessary ingredients for a successful projection: giggles, bare legs, shyness. The goal is to be both irresistible and invisible. When you succeed, a certain sharpness will go out of his eyes. Some powerful men actually call their beauties beauty. Counter to reputation, there is a deep camaraderie among beauties. If your designated mate is widely feared, the beauties at the house party where you've gone undercover to meet him will be especially kind. Kindness feels good, even when it's based on a false notion of your identity and purpose. Posing as a beauty means not reading what you would like to read on a rocky shore in the south of France. Sunlight on bare skin can be as nourishing as food. Even a powerful man will be briefly self-conscious when he first disrobes to his bathing suit. It is technically impossible for a man to look better in a Speedo than in swim trunks. If you love someone with dark skin, white skin looks drained of something vital. When you know that a person is violent and ruthless, you will see that violent ruthlessness in such basic things as his swim stroke. What are you doing from your designated mate amid choppy waves after he has followed you into the sea may or may not betray suspicion. Your reply, swimming, may or may not be perceived as sarcasm. Shall we swim together toward those rocks may or may not be a question. All that way, if spoken correctly, should sound ingenuous. We'll have privacy there. May sound unexpectedly ominous. 100 feet of blue-black Mediterranean will allow you ample time to deliver a strong self-lecture. At such moments, it may be useful to explicitly recall your training. You will be infiltrating the lives of criminals. You will be in constant danger. Some of you will not survive, but those who do will be heroes. A few of you will save lives and even change the course of history. We ask of you an impossible combination of traits: ironclad scruples and a willingness to violate them, an abiding love for your country and a willingness to consort with individuals who are working actively to destroy it, the instincts and intuition of experts, and the blank records and true freshness of ingenues. You will each perform this service only once, after which you will return to your lives. We cannot promise that your lives will be exactly the same when you go back to them. Thank you.
Jennifer Egan reading the beginning of her story, Black Box, published by The New Yorker magazine. So did the idea of publishing a story on Twitter happen first, or did that idea for a story happened first?
The idea of publishing a story on or writing it for Twitter happened first. And as you say, it was strange because I had been a pretty unsuccessful tweeter. I had felt very self-conscious when I tried to tweet, and then someone infiltrated my account and spewed out a lot of vitamin advertisements. So that was basically the extent of
really,
my tweeting.
I bought those vitamins on your account. Right. So once you had, I'm going to do this on Twitter, the idea of a spy novel thing flowed from that?
I think it was really just, I wondered, okay, what kind of story could live in this form? And I was particularly interested in the serialization and the sort of real-time emergence of one short iteration after another. And it took a while to hear a voice that could live in that kind of space. And really the key to it was the idea that the voice never really addresses the reader directly and never really describes action. The voice only reflects on what she's learned from each thing that happens. And that actually arose out of a list I was keeping on my iPhone of lessons I had learned from things I'd done wrong. Like, don't buy a Christmas tree that's too wide because it blocked all the light from the window that it was in front of. And I thought, well, if you just say don't buy a Christmas tree that's too wide, we can sort of infer what the problem might have been. And so it becomes this kind of interesting way to tell a story through the reflection of the action rather than the action itself.
It's so interesting. This isn't the first time you've used technology to become a thing in your fiction writing obstacle course. You had this great, amazing chapter in Goon Squad that was a PowerPoint presentation. Is that what it's like? Is you have this notion of, a PowerPoint presentation. How can I make that successful in a work of art?
Yes, and often I have very little experience with the technology. So, for example, with PowerPoint, I had never actually used it at all when I had the idea. But it takes a while. I mean, if I could just graft any form onto any story, it would be easy. But in fact, it really has to be a story that couldn't be told any other way. And that is something that I often just have to wait for. I'll hear a certain voice, a kind of tone that I think maybe could live in this sort of odd structure.
You've talked about writing fiction, speaking of spy stories, as living a double life, almost like a spy. Talk about that. What do you mean?
Well, I just mean that I'm living a fairly conventional life in my real life, but I feel like I have this alternate world that I'm visiting all the time. I mean, I think it's why people play video games or like to live in virtual reality worlds. I can really understand that because in a way I feel like I'm doing that all the time, and I don't know what it would be like not to have that other world to go to or to sort of to have that the kind of synchronicity between the two. It's something I really thrive on.
So instead of having to have affairs and secret spy lives, you just go into your make-believe room.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one reason that I never write about my own life, you know, because for me that would really defeat
the purpose. You weren't kept in a crazy castle and you didn't do all these things? No? Those aren't real?
I'm so sorry to disappoint you. But yeah, I think for me, the idea that it's the feeling of being lifted out of my life into another world that is the thrill of writing fiction. When I have to write about myself, I feel really bored and stymied.
And talking about if a Christmas tree blocks the light, probably would be boring, frankly,
exactly.
In a work of fiction. You've talked also about how panic attacks shaped you as a writer. How so?
Well, I mean, I'm a pretty panicky person. I think I've gotten a little better as I've gotten older, but I had I had never heard of a panic attack. That term, I think, had not yet been coined when I really experienced this, which was when I was 18. I had a backpack and went to Europe, bought a Eurail pass, and just traveled around by train. And I began to have these, you know, bouts of terror. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. I really thought I was losing my mind. And it was, as you can imagine, awful. And I would dread the arrival of this state. I never knew when it would come, and I would sort of think it was going to happen, but then it didn't. And then when it did, there was no mistaking it. And then I would think, well, that will never happen again. So it was awful, and then it would happen. But what came out of it, interestingly, was the choice to be a writer, because what I found was that it was writing that seemed to not only anchor me, I mean, it couldn't solve the terror, but somehow narrating it made it feel like I was somehow ultimately in control of it rather than the other way around. So I came back from that trip, which was the end of a year off between high school and college, determined to be a writer.
And did the panic attacks stop?
They did. I mean, being traveling alone in Europe was probably a fairly extreme state for a panicky 18-year-old to be in.
Yeah.
I think, too, you know, it was a kind of isolation that we absolutely do not have anymore. I mean, this was obviously, you know, this was...
Because of devices,
1981. Because of devices. I mean, I grew up in San Francisco, so if I was in Europe, it was a 9-hour time difference, and I would wait in line at a international calling place, and maybe someone would answer the phone, or maybe I'd get a busy signal after all that. So I felt really cut off, and so when I came back to college, it just felt like the most comfortable, you know, cloistered place in the world. It was great.
When we talked last after Goon Squad had come out, you said you were working on a new novel set in the 1940s. Is that still the work in progress?
Yes, it is.
How's it going?
I was hoping you wouldn't ask. It's a pretty fascinating experience, actually. I'm reminded of a few things. One is that it's just so hard to really write a decent book. I mean, it's just so tough. You know, even if maybe you think you came close to doing it once or twice, it doesn't really help. It's interesting. I feel that I've done stuff that some people think is daring, like writing in Twitter or PowerPoint. But to me, I guess maybe that had become almost a path of least resistance, because what I'm finding is that I can't seem to make any bell or whistle really work in this new book. It just has to be kind of a straight storytelling.
Telegram from Winston Churchill.
And
don't do it.
That is terrifying.
Yeah. And does the fact that A Visit from the Goon Squad was so successful in every respect add to the sort of fear?
I'm sure it does, although I always feel very afraid as I work on books, or at least for part of the time. I feel a huge pressure every time. I can't say that it's worse. I had forgotten how bad it is to feel that pressure and to worry that, you know, you can't make the book good. I mean, it's really, it's a, like any job, it has its stressful moments.
And is the fear predictable in the course of writing a book? I mean, at the beginning when the mountain still seems so high, or does it come later when, like, oh, this is crap? Or when does it happen?
I think it depends on the book, actually. It's been different every time. This one, I would say, I've learned another thing, which is that while I don't use my own life, as I said before, I'm very reliant on my own memory of times and places, so I feel very cut off from that, being outside of my lifetime. And that is actually very scary to me. I feel sort of unmoored. And so it's a huge challenge. I'm not quite sure I can pull it off, but then I think, well, if, you know, if I'm doing something I know I can pull off, that's not the book I should be writing.
Absolutely right. I can't wait to read it, and I'm sure your millions of fans can't either. Jennifer Egan, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jennifer Egan is the author of The Keep, A Visit from the Goon Squad, and other novels. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a gigantic hand to Jenny Egan, Hari Kondabolu, Andrew Bird, and Tift Merritt. And thank you all from the bottom of our hearts for coming to Studio 360 live at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, our debut. I hope you had a good time.